little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelich, here with the other host of the show, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
Well, we have kind of a unique show planned for this episode. I like to call it the Bob and Julia Unleashed episode. Julia will tell you a little bit more about what that cryptic clue means.
As for today's topic, as Bob mentioned, we are unleashing Bob and Julia. In this episode, we have no guests. It's just us. I'm Julia, here with Bob. And the topics are going to be varied, but things that we've probably talked about before. Bob and I will take turns asking each other a number of questions, which we will both have seen and agreed to discuss prior. We will use the they say, I say format suggestive of writing recommended by previous Thinking Clearly guests Gerald Graff and Kathy Birkenstein from episode 109. So I'll ask the first question, and then after Bob's response, I'll give my response to the question. And from there, we'll have a short discussion, making sure we understand each other's input, and then move on to the next question. So let's get started and unleash Bob and Julia. Okay, our first question for you, Bob.
I'm ready.
What does our show's name mean to you, Thinking Clearly? How does Thinking Clearly represent our show?
I had to go back and remember it clearly. You know, that's been almost 10 years back there when we started the show on KMUD. So maybe my recollection, I'll be interested in your response to this question, because maybe my recollection is a little foggy. But I remember we wanted to do something on critical thinking. We loved that topic. And so we did some other shows first, which were pilot tests in a way of the show Thinking Clearly. And we had to come up with a name, and so we wanted to get something, since we're going to podcast the show too, we wanted to get something that wasn't taken already. So I remember going back and doing some searches. One of our options was the term Thinking Clearly, the name Thinking Clearly for our show. So I went back and did some searches, and I couldn't find any podcasts or anything like that that were named Thinking Clearly. So that was clear. But there was a book by somebody whose name was Dobelli Rolf. Now, I had to go back and look this up. But he was a Swiss person writing in German, and he published his book. It was called, in German, it was called Kunst des Klaren Denkens. You know, so we could have called ourselves Klaren Denkens or Denkens Klaren, something like that. But that actually translates into English, and he put the book out first in German and then in English. He did an English version in 2013. And the book was called The Art of Thinking Clearly. And actually, he has a very good search presence. He comes up way before we do and still does. So he has a better presence than we do, you know, in terms of doing a search on Google. So that's how I remember that we chose that name. And what I like about that name is it makes thinking prominent in our show. I believe our show is about thinking. It's about critical thinking, but for some reason we didn't want to just call it critical thinking. So Thinking Clearly just had a ring to it in my mind, and thinking was prominent, so I liked that. The clearly part is a little more sort of poetic or ambiguous as to what that means, but to me, when I think about that name, the clearly means that it's thoughts that are unencumbered as they can be by some of the pollution that gets in our way, our cognitive vulnerabilities, our lack of understanding about how to vet information and that kind of thing. So I think it's a perfect name for our show. I like it very much. There's so much that the clearly adds to the thinking part that I'm very satisfied and glad that we named the show Thinking Clearly. How about you?
I like our name too. I think it's interesting. I kind of came at this question from a much more surface level, literal perspective of Thinking is a thing that we do, whether we realize it or not, whether it's conscious or it's unconscious, thinking is happening. Sometimes it happens fast, sometimes it happens slow. And assuming we have free will, how we think and the things we think about and the conclusions we come to can make a great difference in our lives and how we live our lives and the outcomes of our lives. And so it's worth thinking about thinking and taking a look at that a little bit more in depth. I wasn't motivated to go into like kind of the history of how we got there, but just at a surface level, it's what we are. We're thinking clearly the radio show. And clearly, I think is interesting because I feel like this is a metaphor that comes up in our language quite a bit where we say, my thinking was clouded after I had a couple drinks and we talked about that thing, or I didn't sleep well and I'm kind of foggy. And so thinking, like you said, it is to have thinking that is kind of unimpeded without interference. And that takes a certain amount of effort to say, okay, like we think, thinking is a thing that we do, whether we realize it or not, whether we do it well or not as well. And then things impede how we think. And part of thinking clearly is to be aware of those things. And I think most of all, the challenge is here we are at more than 100 hour-long radio shows. We've covered quite a lot of thinking. And to try and distill what it is we want to do into something that is a radio show title, I think is very challenging and something that would never really be perfect. But I agree that thinking clearly really does kind of distill the essence of what it is that I think we're trying to do here.
Very good. And I love the way that you smuggled in thinking fast and slow. Where did you ever come up with that?
Well, I didn't come up with it.
That's a famous book by Daniel Kahneman. And Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize for his work in heuristics and biases. And we've done it a lot on this show of thinking fast and slow. It's called the dual process model, right? We start out first with an intuitive hit on something, and that's what first comes to our mind. And if it's a simple subject, whether to run from the bear or not, then great, we have that fast thinking. If it's a more complex subject, like thinking about the cultural change and events that are happening in our political system in the world, then we need to slow our thinking down and go with the more analytical tools that we have in slow thinking. So one of the things that I learned, I didn't know anything about Daniel Kahneman and his work before we started this show. We've done a lot. We've talked to a lot of really great guests, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later in the show. But let's go to my question for you now. This has haunted me for many years on this show, and I'm not sure how I feel about it. So I'm interested in your opinion on this. And the question is persuasion appropriate in critical thinking? And if so, how sure do we have to be about our conclusions in our arguments to move into the realm of persuasion?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think it's, for me, it's really hard to give just a concise answer, because first I would say, good luck removing persuasion from thinking. We can, we do, but it requires a great deal of effort, you know, and I think that's part of what the scientific method is about, is really trying to remove some of the motivated thinking, I should say. But persuasion is very much a part of our life day in and day out. These are my words, but soft persuasion or hard persuasion. If I were to say, you know, Bob, I haven't seen you for a month. You're nothing but skin and bones. Let me feed you some dinner. I'm persuading you to eat dinner. Why is that? Is it because I'm trying to sell you something and I happen to make the greatest dinner of all and it's going to cost you $25? Is it because I'm genuinely cared about your well-being as an empathetic friend? Is it because I happen to think I'm the best cook ever and I want everyone to indulge my narcissism? So, you know, I use that as an example because it's persuasion. Bob, I want to feed you. Let me persuade you into eating my dinner. But what's the motivation behind it? Is it truly empathetic? Is it selfish? Is it greedy? You know, is it to make money? And I think that's where persuasion sometimes gets a bad rap, is we have a lot of people trying to sell us stuff, whether it's, you know, ideological, trying to sell us on a savior, trying to sell us on a church, trying to sell us on somebody else's way of thinking, trying to sell us literally on goods and services that we may or may not need. And I would say even by doing this show, we're trying to persuade people to use critical thinking. Are we doing that in like a hard sell, or is there something in it for us? I don't think so. But it's because I'll speak for myself, I value critical thinking, and I value the skill that it takes that otherwise wouldn't be constantly working on this. This isn't something you just obtain one day and haha, I'm a critical thinker. But wanting to give people in our communities tools for being good critical thinkers. And my motivation is that we improve our own lives and we improve our collective lives. So, you know, I think that's part of why it's such a hard question to answer, is that it's really very pervasive and not necessarily a bad thing, but it's important to identify. And most of all, I think when we're making value judgments about persuasion, it's kind of digging into the motivation behind that persuasion. Again, is it out of empathy and altruism? Is it out of selfishness? Is it out of greed? Or a combination of those things, or something else I haven't mentioned. How about you, Bob?
One of the things that this show has done for me is it doesn't always lead me to, well, now I have an answer for that. But it brings clarity to the questions. And this is a big question for me, because there's a part of me that believes that critical thinking is an ideal that has certain standards. And we take such pains to identify our biases and our motivations. And there is a thing called motivated reasoning that lawyers do, right? They give good, valid, logical arguments, hopefully in court, but they're all geared towards either putting somebody away in jail or freeing them, or whatever the case may be. But that's motivated reasoning. Critical thinking to me is not motivated reasoning. That's why we call it a robust search of evidence in our definition, is we want to look for evidence for and against considering some particular issue. So I haven't got the answer to that, and I'm still struggling with it. We've had a guest who's my mentor, one of my mentors for critical thinking, Kevin De La Plante. He's the creator of the Critical Thinking Academy and the Argument Ninja Dojo. So think about that name, Argument Ninja Dojo. Yes, he saw critical thinking as self-defense, but sometimes the best defense is an offense. And so if you're doing martial arts, for example, yes, you want to defend yourself, but you also want to be able to go on the offensive in some martial art forms. So he believed very strongly that persuasion was not only appropriate, but it was necessary in critical thinking. And I know that we talked about that on episode 100, and I was very interested in getting his views on that. Now, he did not persuade me. He gave me food for thought, but he believes very strongly that persuasion is appropriate. I am still thinking that if you have an argument, a good argument, that you've probed with critical thinking, and that it stands up to critical thinking, that if you are engaging in communication with another person in a good faith argument, a good faith conversation, where you're both struggling, this is the ideal, you're both struggling to find out what's most likely to be true in this particular situation, what has the evidence and what's supported. So how can we make a tentative belief or opinion that's based on evidence? If you're both struggling with that, then you shouldn't be trying to persuade each other. You should be trying to develop the strongest argument that you can, and that the argument should persuade itself. Now, that's the ideal. How does that work in the real world? Probably not very well. And besides, we don't know what our motivations are. A lot of what goes on with us, as we were talking to Mary Helen Immordino Yang, our guest for last October, her evidence and her belief is that emotions motivate our thinking no matter what. Thinking and our emotions are also influenced by our values. And a lot of that happens unconsciously. We're not aware of it. So I can't deny that that happens. You know, I really believe that most of what happens to us is unconscious, and some of it percolates into our consciousness. So I have to say that I'm still thinking. The decision has not been made yet, one way or the other. I'm still pondering that. Who knows whether I will actually ever know the answer, my own answer to that question. I do think it's a wonderful question. It has so many different aspects to it. I have to say that I do go eyeball to eyeball sometimes with people. So what you said essentially is be aware of your own goals and motivations in what you're doing. There's nothing wrong if you think you have a good argument, if you think that you have put to the test your argument, your belief, your opinion, you've put it to the test of critical thinking, and you want to share that with other people and persuade them that that's a good argument, show it in its best light, and use other techniques to help develop that argument to the point that it actually becomes their argument. What's wrong with that? So I'm ambivalent with that question.
Sometimes it's fun not to have a conclusion and continue to deliberate something.
That's one of the most wonderful things in life, is when you can see both sides of something, or the many facets of something. They say people need closure. Well, I'm not so sure. I think that depends on the person. You know, some people need closure more than others. It's not going to be one of the things that I regret about my life, is I never came to the conclusion about whether critical thinking should be persuasive or not. But I do know there are times when it's probably best in terms of your values to move beyond critical thinking into persuasion. And sometimes into activism. And that's another thing that comes up in my mind quite often.
I'd like to ask you a question, a clarifying question, because yeah. I think, you know, we talk about things, you know, sort of sometimes in an abstract or in a confined way, but, you know, the living life is often not quite so neutral. And I want to understand a little bit more about your perspective when you say using persuasion in critical thinking. But what I haven't heard is using critical thinking in persuasion. I don't know if that's different or the same. So if I could ask you a hypothetical question, if someone were to accuse you of stealing, and you know in your heart and in your memory that you did not steal, I think most people's natural reaction would be to defend oneself, to make a persuasive argument as to how or why you didn't steal. Would that be correct in assuming that? And then would you apply critical thinking in that defense?
Well, I would try to present the evidence that has persuaded me that I didn't steal. I'm not as ambivalent about the question you just asked me. Yes, in my belief, I believe that persuasion should include critical thinking. The ideal of persuasion is that it does, because if you don't use critical thinking in persuasion, two things. One is you may be way off base. That's why I've always had a problem with, and someone said this, I'm not going to say what the public context was, but someone said to a group of people, and it was some issue, I think it was nuclear power plants and that kind of thing. The statement this person made is, you do not have to understand the science or what's really happening with nuclear power to be against it. That just was like fingernails on a chalkboard to me when I heard that. What? Of course you do. In other words, you could be out demonstrating your heart out, just feeling all the emotion that you're right with a cause. And if you have not examined that belief that you're out in favor of critically, then that's the danger of not using critical thinking in all your thinking. I believe that any time that you're going to be motivated to do something, persuade somebody, yes, I think you have to be pretty sure that you're right, pretty sure that you've examined the issue as thoughtfully as you can and be able to defend it with a critical argument. There are activists and there are theorists. You know, there are people who have developed the theory, and then there are people that are willing to go out, and maybe they haven't thought that much about the issue, but they're emotionally motivated to do something. It's more emotion, less putting it through the sieve of critical thinking and critical analysis. And that can be dangerous, I think. And I don't want to ever do that. If I'm motivated to activism, I'm pretty sure that I've analyzed the topic thoroughly in my mind.
I think that's something that I haven't necessarily teased apart yet in my own thinking, is the difference between critical thinking in persuasion and persuasion in critical thinking. To me, they're still kind of amalgamated into the same thing. So I think maybe that's something for me to dig into and understand a little bit more.
Yeah, well, that's great. You know, the other part of this question that comes into my mind, and you got into this a little bit, is putting it in a real life kind of lived experience way, is we are social creatures. There are some psychologists who believe that the essence of language and thought is socially oriented. You know, it's motivated by the fact that we are social creatures. And so there is a thought that all communication and thought is really persuasion. It's persuasion of other people to know and deal with the norms of thought and values that we hold together as a social unit. So there's that part of it. That's another aspect that keeps me sort of vacillating back and forth and thinking about all the nooks and crannies of that question. Well, we could make a whole episode of that.
I'm glad we figured that out. I've got another question for you, Bob.
Okay, good.
All right. Digging into critical thinking a little bit more and kind of thinking a little bit more of an expansive way, we've often visited our definition, our evolving, growing definition of critical thinking as, I think last we left off somewhere around, critical thinking is a mode of thinking that uses the process of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of robust cross-section of evidence related to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions and beliefs. Should we leave out opinions and beliefs? In other words, are opinions and beliefs constrained by the same logic-driven, evidence-based limitations as claims and conclusions? And what about convictions? You touched on that a little bit, but maybe we can start with the beginning part a little bit more. We have, should basically opinions and beliefs be constrained to the same logic-driven, evidence-based limitations as claims and conclusions?
This is one that I'm a little more clear in my mind what my opinion on this is. Many people would believe, you know, there's everybody has a right to their own opinion. That alone sort of gives it the idea that, hey, you don't have to have any reasons for an opinion. And some people actually believe you don't have to have reasons for beliefs. Now, conclusions and claims we're pretty clear on. That comes from logic. It comes from philosophy. If you're going to create a logical argument, then the premises need to be true or strongly probable, if you're doing inductive reasoning, for you to have a valid or strong argument to come to that conclusion. I look at claims and conclusions as the same thing. If you make a claim about something, then the other person has a right and maybe a responsibility to ask, how do you know that's true? What do you base that on? So we're talking about evidence-based situations, claims and conclusions. But beliefs and opinions, I don't think it's as clear. Now, with me, I want my opinions and belief to be evidence-based and to be supported by arguments. I want them to be able to bear the scrutiny of analytic thinking, rational thinking, logical analysis. In other words, I would probably never go out and say this is my opinion without at least having the idea that that opinion could be supported by evidence. Now, in my mind, beliefs are stronger than opinions. In other words, the way I make sense out of this is that opinions, in my way of thinking, should be based on evidence, just as claims and conclusions, but are a little less defensible in terms of the enormity of the evidence. In other words, I might have an opinion. It's kind of like the fast thinking. I might have an opinion on something, but when somebody asks me, well, what's that based on? I would probably, in some opinions, I might have to scamper a little bit, or I might have to say, let me get back to you on that. And then I'd have to really go in and see, did it live up to, you know, this standard of evidence-based conclusions? So I, in my mind, opinions, you cut them a little bit more freedom. They may or may not be true, but I would never give an opinion that I don't think I could really go out and find evidence for. Beliefs are a little stronger. Beliefs are a little more general, I think, you know, than opinions, in my mind. And beliefs, again, should bear the scrutiny of critical thinking, because I think beliefs form the basis of our realities. You know, they form the basis of our worldviews. And in my opinion, no, in my belief, worldviews should be, and here we're moving away from the descriptive into a normative, you know.
Unleash it, Bob, unleash it.
Descriptive, something that is a fact, if we look hard enough for evidence, we're going to all possibly agree on, into a normative or a value-based, whenever that word should comes up. So we're on a little softer ground. I mean, we have to do a little more work. We have to talk about our values when we use the word should or ought or good or bad. But in my opinion, actually in my belief, that we'd all be better off if our beliefs were subject to critical thinking and we looked for evidence, because our beliefs make up our reality. And I feel very strongly, it's one of the reasons I think a lot about critical thinking, is because I have a very strong conviction that our beliefs stand the test of critical thinking, that our beliefs should be evidence-based, because it gives us a better read on reality, what's really out there. And that is, in my belief, necessary to make good decisions and necessary for our civilization, our culture. That's a long answer to your question. And I did look up Merriam-Webster definitions of belief and opinions, and I'm not going to read those. It's basically where I came up with the idea that opinions are a little less formal than beliefs, and not nearly as formal as conclusions and claims. That's my answer.
A little off topic, but I would say that it's always important to define our terms. Mm-hmm. And when I was looking at our previous question about persuasion, one of the first things I did was open up the dictionary on the internet, look at persuasion. So it's you're never too old to open a dictionary and to revisit how terms are defined when, you know, we're going to be talking about such things.
Yeah, that's very good. And we probably talked about that in our very first episode of Thinking Clearly, is the importance of defining the terms, especially when you're talking with someone else, because a lot of arguments are over unspoken differences of definition of what something means. So if you can at least come to a common definition, or at least a common understanding of each other's definition of something, then you've made the first hurdle in the argument. So defining your terms, I mean, that's your background in philosophy. That's what philosophy does for us. It examines in very deeply the meaning of our words, our language, the meaning of our thought. Where do you stand on this? Should we throw opinions? I'm willing to at least maybe throw opinions out of the definition, but I would make a case for leaving claims, conclusions, and beliefs.
I really like the way you answered the question, and I don't know that I could really answer it much better myself. I think we agree certainly on 99% of it. I think that's interesting. I think leaving opinions and beliefs in there is great and good. To me, if I were to remove one, I would remove them both and not just one. So I pretty much agree with your assessment of how claims and conclusions differ from opinions, which differ from beliefs. You highlighted a word also that came to my mind, which is worldviews, which plays an important role in all of this. I actually find a utility in sort of separating these things apart, you know, because not everything in my brain and how I go about the, you know, living my life in the world is going to be as thorough and structured as claims and conclusions. That's simply, I don't have the energy for that. But it's an important thing to know when we're talking about really how to formulate an argument, a good argument, and what makes a good argument. Having valid claims, having a valid argumentation structure so that your conclusions are also valid and true, those sorts of things. And I think it's important to have ways that there's a utility to sort of dividing out, okay, this is my opinion. Have I fully vetted it as a claim and a conclusion? No. Do I want to? Well, maybe. Maybe at some point. Maybe I'm chipping away at that. Maybe I don't. Maybe it's an opinion I'm okay holding without having the full background of a claim and a conclusion. For instance, I think mayonnaise is gross. That's my opinion. And maybe I'm entitled to that opinion. And to me, it is gross. I'm not going to say it's gross for everybody. That I do feel I would need a little bit more of, like, you know, some evidence behind. But I can say for me in my experience, do I need a whole good faith argument to outline why that's true? I don't feel the need for it because it's my own opinion, right? It's my own belief. I also think that opinions and beliefs can be a playground for vetting ideas. So I can say, you know, I met this person, John Doe, and my initial impression is that they're a jerk. And that's how I feel about that. And I can say, well, you know, the evidence that they're a jerk is because they did X, Y, and Z. And to me, that makes them a jerk. And I believe that they also hate kittens, right? Do I have any evidence to support that? No. Am I aware? This is another important difference. Am I aware that I don't have any evidence to support that? Because sometimes we have beliefs where there is no evidence, and yet we treat that belief as if there is. Mm-hmm. And I think having self-awareness to say, okay, my opinion is that person's a jerk and I believe that they hate kittens. Do I know that for a fact? Am I going to make that claim and conclusion with other people and try and persuade them to believe that as well? No, not really, because I don't really have any evidence behind it. You know, what is my motivation for wanting to convince other people that this person's a jerk and they hate kittens, right? And then maybe also I hold that opinion in what I'll call my playground, where there is, you know, maybe some mutability, you know, and I have some interactions with this person. I go, oh, maybe they're not as much of a jerk as my first initial impression. And now there's room for that opinion to grow. And maybe my unjustified belief that they hate kittens starts to subside. And I go, well, maybe my initial assessment was a little unreasonable. And there's room for that to grow. You know, hopefully, like, based on evidence, based on, like, having more interactions with this person, I go, oh, well, you know, they're not as much of a jerk as I initially assessed them to be. And so my opinion changes with evidence. I think these things all have, they're sort of, I don't know if like spectrum's the right word, mm-hmm. but they exist and play with each other. And I think most of all, having these words to identify the different types of thoughts in my own mind and where they exist and how they may or may change. Because something to me that is a claim and a conclusion is not as mutable. It's much more figured out and based in reality, based on evidence, based on a good structured argument, free of fallacies and that sort of thing. And that just that can't be everything, you know? It's, I think, unrealistic to kind of move through the world so that claims and conclusions are the only thing that we have to base our perspectives off of.
Very good. What I really liked about what you just said are a couple of things. It made me think of some new thoughts. One, opinions have a bit more subjectivity involved, right? In other words, you like this particular food or don't like this particular food. Well, that's a subjective experience. You know, how can you defend that? I don't have to defend it. I don't like it. It doesn't appeal to me. So you really don't need to examine a lot of evidence for that kind of opinion. So that's one thing that it made me think is that opinion and maybe beliefs have a little bit more subjectivity involved. And that the second thing that I really like is the idea that opinions are kind of like seeds for our beliefs. You know, they're germs that can grow, a germ in terms of a seed, or they're pilot testing for our beliefs, and that's the real function of an opinion. You don't have to have it all thought out, and you're not going to convince anybody else because there's no need to exactly have it in full flower. So I like that idea. There's only one other aspect of this that I want to touch on but not spend too much time on, is that if we say beliefs are subject to the same kind of evidence-based analysis as our claims and conclusions are, then where does that leave the beliefs of people of faith? People of faith would say, I have faith.
Don't have an answer for you.
Don't ask me for evidence. You know, I have faith. So that's another little aspect, you know, that comes into this point is, in that definition that we use, are we leaving out people of faith? Just something to think about. I don't want to, actually, that's another episode in itself. And we did have an episode of Thinking Clearly where we talked to a pastor and we talked about some of our points of agreement. He was an apologetic, not that he was saying he was sorry, but apologetics is the idea that if you have a religion, you can actually look for evidence, right? Is that what apologetics is? Do I have that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So he understood the idea of evidence-based a little bit more maybe than some people. So at any rate, that's that question. Let's move on. Here's another question for you this time from me. What's the most frustrating aspect for you of our current state of information exchange and interaction regarding politics and beliefs?
Oh boy, there's, you did say most frustrating because there's many sources these days, but really the first thing that came to mind with this question was epistemic crisis, something we've talked about on this show a few times. What is epistemic crisis? It comes from the word epistemology, which is about knowing truth. How do we know truth? And a lot of the questions that come with that, we don't necessarily need to get into, but, you know, how do we have evidence? How do we measure things that are true? How do we know that we know things are true? And I think there's a lot of things to disagree about these days, but I think something a lot of us are seeing in our country today is a fundamental breakdown of what is true and how we know truth. And, you know, it used to be very simple that even not that long ago, you could go on the internet, you could type in a question into a search engine, which Google became synonymous with, and we could come up with some reliable information. Wikipedia has been an absolute foundational piece of peer review information resources. And even that, which I thought was untouchable to an extent, has become a target for, you know, so even the very institutions which have been developed to look at truth and what is true and what is evidence and measurable have been under fire. And it's very hard to even engage in discussion or an exchange of ideas if the very foundation of what we understand truth to be and what we understand evidence to be is not shared broadly. And I really find this to be absolutely the most challenging. You can also look at who's experts. I think that's something that has been consistently under fire, you know, is someone, even if they're a scientist, a researcher, someone who follows, you know, the scientific method, who has a lot of discipline in how they do research and how they measure and garner evidence, comes under personal attack by motivated people. And then all of a sudden, the work that they've done also becomes questionable. When I think part of, and I want to speak for you, but I think part of what we seek to do with enhancing the skill of critical thinking is to know that good thinking, good evidence and arguments that lead to good and valid conclusions remain valid and good no matter who practices that or who measures and makes those arguments and comes to those conclusions, that it exists independently. And that is something also that we're seeing in our country and beyond, you know, is a lot of, I think this is where things are no longer good faith. You know, as we make personal attacks on people to try to discredit them instead of the ideas themselves and attacking the foundation from which those ideas come, whether they're universities or schools of thought or something like that. And, you know, we've never, in from my perspective, in my opinion, we have never been more fractured as far as the very foundational way in which we view the world and interact with each other.
Exactly. Well, you said you don't want to speak for me. Well, you just did, because I agree with everything you said. You know, the manipulation. I mean, we've always had manipulation and people trying to sell us things and that kind of thing, but we've never had the reach, the megaphone that the internet has given us. And so that manipulation, and coupled with the business model of people on the internet, and how do you make money on the internet? You're providing some service of some sort. Well, you do by manipulating people to go to it, clickbait, and, you know, influencers now. And that led to more polarization and more politicization of information, using information for a political agenda of some sort. All of that coupled with, and I just have to get political here, because it is one of the big issues. We started this program, I wrote a note, we started this program, like I said, in August of 2016. That was 6 months before Kellyanne Conway, who was at that point the president's counselor to President Trump in his first term, used the phrase alternative facts. And obviously the whole way that things were going, people had to do a march on science stand up for science. I'd never heard of that in my life. Of course you you believe in science, you know. So there was so much going on at that time. Altogether, it was kind of a perfect storm. Yeah, the internet gave the reach. The business people had to create a business model that required them to manipulate people's habits in terms of what they actually used on the internet and clicked to. There were things that there was the ability to pop screens up on people and drive them in certain ways. So all of that together, and with some issues that had been brewing for a long time that led us to political differences, just enhanced to the nth degree the political polarization. And the willingness, the thing that gets to me more than anything, is the attempt to alter people's reality and the willingness of those people to go along with it. You know, that's why, you know, one of my motivations is to keep harping. We don't do a lot of political issues. We try to stick as much as we can to the process of critical thinking, hoping that people will pick up on that, hoping that people will see the value in that, and that the good arguments will survive the test of true critical thinking, not motivated reasoning. Now, so I think we agree very closely on those issues.
Yeah, and I'll just add too, I think something that, you know, something that we probably don't bring up enough, you know, is the idea of good faith arguments and bad faith arguments, or arguments that are not in good faith. And I think something that a very underrated tool that critical thinking has empowered me is in seeing and understanding the tools of manipulation that other people use when not having good faith arguments. And I say that in that sometimes it's unconsciously and sometimes it's done unconsciously. It's not always, you know, bad actors. Sometimes it is bad actors, but for instance, something that I never really thought was as powerful as I've come to believe it is simply the rhetoric of repetition.
Yes.
If you say something that is not true over and over and over and over again, even when people are making good faith claims and conclusions with good evidence and good valid arguments, and you keep repeating that bad faith falsehood on repeat, it does affect people. It does impact the public discourse. And I'm not going to get into examples, but I can think of a few where something that is just absolutely overtly not true has been put on repeat over and over and over again. And, you know, everyone may not buy it, but the fact that it's in there in the public discourse on repeat does affect perspectives and the way that we interact with each other and the conclusions we come to. And I see that, especially in the last few years, really being used by bad faith actors in bad faith arguments.
Yeah. And part of that is talking points. People, you'll hear the same talking points over and over and over again, almost verbatim, word for word. And when I hear talking points, then I'm pretty sure the person hasn't really, you know, examined the issue. There's too much willingness to throw any kind of talking point information, reality, person's own reality out there for an agenda, you know, and that's what I consider a bad faith argument, is when two people or more are not engaging an issue and a subject based on mutually trying to analyze it, to understand it, to see what their points of agreement are and what their points of difference are. That would be a good faith argument. All other arguments, whether it's just talking points, where it's a shouting match, where it's whoever talks loudest, yells loudest, reaches the most people, that's a bad faith situation, communication. Okay, let's move on. You have another question for me?
Yes. I think this one's a little more imaginative. So let's put our little thinking caps on, our imagination caps. If we could get any guest on this program, any guest at all, real, fictional, alive, dead, both alive and dead, any guest at all, who would you really like to talk with, and what would the topics be?
Yeah, a little more tangible, a little more concrete question than we've been getting into in our previous questions. So, yeah, this isn't as hard for me. My response is, Here's my list. President Barack Obama, Alan Alda, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Bill Nye, the science guy, and George Lakoff. And those are all people that I've actually invited onto Thinking Clearly. You know, send them invitations. And they never got back to me. You know, that doesn't happen very often. But none of those folks did. But they would all be people that I would have liked to get on our show. And the big one for me is Daniel Kahneman. We talked about him a moment ago because I think he would have actually. He was on a lot of podcasts, and he was pretty willing in his later years to talk about issues, and I think he might have actually agreed to come on. It would have been a wonderful experience, but he is gone to the great beyond and is now unavailable.
Well, you never know. We could try.
How about you?
I'm going to break up the format a little bit, but just to return to what you're saying with Kahneman, what topics would you like to talk with him about? Something that comes up for me is that didn't he kind of change his mind, his perspective a bit throughout his lifetime as far as how he viewed the world?
I didn't get the sense that he changed his perspective, but I've heard him a number of times in interviews say that, yes, as deeply as he studied heuristics and biases, that he is still subject to those, that it is a very, very difficult thing to do, to spot your own biases and to move beyond that. And for him to say that, I mean, you know, for someone who studies something, you would think that that would be prominent in their mind and that they would just catch themselves all the time if they were starting to do that. So that way, that, you know, that's what I remember him saying. I don't know that he actually changed his mind a lot, except that he acknowledged that it's very difficult to do anything about for most people. Yeah, and it's always easier to spot other people's biases than our own.
Well, speak for yourself. I kicked around this question quite a bit, and I think there could be a lot of different answers for myself. But ultimately, what I came back to is if I had a magic wand and I could invite anybody, I really would want to talk with someone who is seen as brilliant in retrospect and had a huge influence on the world as it is today, but also faced incredible adversity in their lifetime. Uh-huh. And so some of the ones that came to my mind, I got three names here. Galileo, who, hello, heliocentric solar system, like, you know, we all take it for granted today, but he had the crushing pressure of the Catholic Church when he said that stuff out loud. Marie Curie, brilliant, and I think also as a female scientist who made incredible inroads in science, I would be really interested in her perspective and how she managed through that. And then lastly, a name that came up recently that is always dear to my heart and is not a scientist at all in any way, but a high school dropout like myself, Eugene Debs.
Eugene,
a guy
Debs.
Who
yes.
Ran for president multiple times from jail. Mm-hmm. And I just really admire his strength and willpower and conviction. And and it all, from what I know of him, came from a motivation of really wanting to see good in the world and people live healthy, robust, fulfilling lives.
And he was quoted recently by our new mayor of New York, correct?
Well, I mean, he's not my mayor. I don't live in New York, but he's the... I hope we all see him as the people's mayor, Zohran Mamdani of New York City, Democratic Socialist, who, yes, basically opened up his victory speech with a quote from Eugene Debs, which I thought was bold and awesome. Mm-hmm. And I do have a little bit of a crush.
On Eugene Debs or the new mayor?
Kind of, yeah.
Or both. All right.
Well, you know, but... But here, I'm sitting at my work desk, and nearest to me, I have pictures of Eugene Debs and Mother Jones. So those are some of my day-to-day inspirations for sure.
Well, I'm looking at our list of questions, and we have 1, 2, 3, 4 more questions and no more time.
Yeah.
I love to say the sand has run out of our hourglass here on thinking clearly. But just quickly, do you have any last thoughts of that you'd like to pass on to our listeners?
Oh, just I think the value in, I mentioned earlier, sort of the playground of opinions and how things, you know, we can remain open to new ideas and to changing our own minds. And really something I remind myself pretty often about that we've talked about on the show quite a bit is curiosity. Curiosity can take so much of this stuff that feels so gross and so frustrating in the world right now, and can really bring a little bit of light and, should I say, even fun and interest into the world that we're living in.
Julia, this has been fun. We've been unleashed. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure as always, and it's been an amazing almost 10 years now. It's been an amazing 100-plus episodes, and I look forward to 100 more.
And I want to give a big hearty thanks to our listeners for your support. And until next time, keep thinking.
Clearly.
Please don't drop the ball. Just be sure to do your hoo.